All right, the Greg Kelly podcast. Hello. O.J. Simpson died not too long ago at the age of 76, cancer. I was not surprised or shocked. I mean, that's, but he had been on my mind in just in the past couple of weeks. I had, what had I done? I just gone through a bunch of different documentaries. And I have to say, over the past couple of years, I started to reevaluate or rethink his guilt or innocence. I kind of assumed, like everybody else, he was guilty. But a couple of years ago, I saw a video that he made in the mid-90s, 96, I believe, might have been 97. This is after he was acquitted. And he's with a film crew, and he's walking around his house, the house on Rockingham, the famous house that he returned to after the slow speed chase. And he's explaining to the camera, like, how he could not have done it and how the case against him made no sense. And he's pointing to where things were alleged to have happened or where blood was found, and just saying the whole thing was impossible. And it made an impression. I'm like, a guilty person doesn't do that. I just can't imagine. I know, look, you could be psychotic, you could be this, you could be that, but I didn't think that that is the activity of a guilty man. And I think that was a real moment where I thought maybe everybody was wrong about this. But then again, I don't know. What do I know? And I have other things to do. So I resume my life. I watch all the miniseries and whatever, and 30 on 30 or the O.J. Simpson story, the one where Cuba Gooding Jr. played O.J. Look, bottom line is this. I really think there's a significant chance the guy was innocent. And I've been thinking about it a lot, and I've been studying it. Granted, there are millions of facts about this case that I don't know, but I've been introduced to some facts that I never knew, and I think certainly reasonable doubt it expands exponentially when you find out what I'm about to tell you. So what else about it? I thought about who told us that he was guilty. Who insisted that O.J. Simpson was guilty? Well, you could say three entities or forces. Number one, our culture, our corrupt and depraved culture, has said from day one that O.J. was the killer, right? I mean, and you know, and I know how corrupt and vile our culture is. It is. I'm not saying I'm an Amish person or whatever. I look at the internet. I do all kinds. Yeah, but let's face it, we're pretty depraved as a society. We just are. There's that. And then the media told us he was guilty and tells us he's guilty. And the media back then was much, in a way, smaller than it is today. We only had, this is 94, 95. Yeah, we had cable TV. We certainly didn't have social media. None of this evidence was tested against a mass audience, which, oh, by the way, I think is incredibly helpful sometimes. We had ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN. I think MSNBC had just showed up telling us that O.J. was guilty. Fox News had not arrived on the scene, actually. They started in 96. He was acquitted in October of 1995. So we had the media and our general culture telling us that this guy was guilty. And also, I guess, we have the city of Los Angeles, right? The state of California, the authorities told us. Now, I view those three forces today as completely and totally and thoroughly corrupt. Absolutely. And it's almost a throwback to better times or more wholesome times when we believed our culture, when we believed our media, when we believed the authorities. Now, I support law enforcement, but I have become immersed in police misconduct, and we've all seen it. I've seen a police officer shoot and kill an unarmed woman in full view of the entire planet, and he was given a gold medal and promoted. This is absurd. And I don't think it happened overnight. A lot of this stuff has been going on for a long time. Now, let me tell you the piece of information that I have, and it's thanks to a guy named William Deere. He's a former police officer, very successful private investigator. He's been working out of Texas, based in Texas, but he's been working all over the world for a long time. And I had heard murmurings about Jason Simpson, the son of OJ, who I believe was, on the night of the murders, he was 24 years old, maybe 23. He was born in 1970. Well, a couple of things about him. Did you know that at the time of the murders, Jason Simpson was on probation for an offense that included an assault with a deadly weapon, and that weapon was a knife? He assaulted somebody with a deadly weapon, a knife. I never knew that. Did you? I also never knew that Jason Simpson had what could be described as pretty serious psychological issues. I did not know that on the night of the murder, June 12th, 1994, we know this from Jason Simpson himself, that he was planning to cook a special dinner for Nicole, her family, for OJ, at a restaurant where he was working. He was the sous chef at a place called Jackson's, which I believe was in Beverly Hills. And he was expecting the entire kind of extended family to come to Jackson's restaurant that night after the dance recital, right? Remember the dance recital? I know this is kind of a long time ago, but that he was expecting them to come. According to Jason Simpson, she canceled and did not come because she said it was too expensive and kind of out of the way. Jason Simpson said in a deposition in the wrongful death suit to attorney Daniel Petroselli, and it's on videotape, that he was hurt by this, that his feelings were hurt, that he was excited. And there are a lot of other little things that will come up in my conversation with William Deere that suggest to me that O.J. Simpson is, in fact, not guilty. Now, again, I know that people will find that abhorrent, but I want you to kind of think about all we know now about everything in our society and how corrupt and warped and how information is kept from us, and disinformation and misinformation from the government is a real thing. And also, I've kind of forgot the name, Mark Furman. That guy is a maniac, or maybe he's got his act together now, but in 1995 and before, that guy was a racist, corrupt, weirdo cop. And I totally can believe, totally and completely can believe that he would have planted evidence, including that glove, and including possibly smearing that glove all over the Bronco. Do I know that 1,000%? No, but I can totally see it. Based on, God, the man filed a lawsuit against the police department in the early 1980s saying that he should be let go for a psychological disability, in part because, well, he was racist. It's just unbelievable what this guy did and what he was about. I totally understand why the jury found him not guilty. Remember, there's an audience and at home, and we were being told things by the media. And there's another thing that's going on, the jury, the what was actually mattered in the courtroom. Look, I know you may not be there yet, and I'm not totally there, but I'm a long way. I'm still kind of grappling with this, and I'm still studying it. But that stuff about Jason Simpson alone, that his feelings were hurt by Nicole, that he had psychological issues, that wherever he went, he took his knives with him. It's true. it's crazy. It's crazy in that we didn't know any of this stuff. Now, I have to say a couple of things. To Jason Simpson or anybody who's been really watching this, I have a little thing that I kind of want to read. I got it from, give me a second. Okay. This is almost like an official statement, all right? The killings of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman are crimes that remain unsolved. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent just some of the many conceivable scenarios regarding how these crimes may have occurred. All right, so I have to be a little bit careful. I do not know if Jason Simpson did this. I don't know if I have not verified a lot of this information. Some of it I have, but there's only so much I can do. I'm reading books that are publicly available. I'm looking at public records. I'm looking at depositions. I'm looking, but that does not tell me everything that one would need to know. So there's a very good chance that, well, number one, I should say Jason Simpson, the son of OJ, who's still alive. I think he's in his early 50s, mid-50s. He's never been charged. He has he's innocent in the eyes of the law, and he may in fact be innocent totally. He might be. There's a chance that he did this. And if so, I guess I strangely I want to kind of just tell him that you can make peace about all of this with God, and you, if you did do this, it's horrible, of course, but it doesn't make you the worst person in the world. A horrible, 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 horrible mistake. But look, I don't know if you did it. All right, I don't. I can't say. William Deere is convinced, a world-renowned investigator, and we're going to go into his background here in a moment. But freedom is available to each and every one of us through God, through Jesus. I do believe. And I also have a fair amount of sympathy for anybody. Look, I love everybody. I don't have to like everybody, but I think he had some pretty unique challenges growing up. We all do. It's not an excuse for anything. Look, I hope the guy's innocent. I don't know. I find the theory, however, very, very compelling. And I do believe that the verdict was a just one. And I never would have thought I'd be saying that, ever. But here we are. Okay, this is my conversation with William Deere. He wrote a book, actually. O.J. Simpson is Innocent, and I Can Prove It. This was also, Is O.J. Innocent, a series that he did on Discovery ID. I don't think that's around anymore, is it? You know, the Discovery Channel, the investigation thing. That series was narrated by Martin Sheen. I mean, incredibly high production values. The foreword to his book was written by Dan Rather, of all people. Dan is... he's become quite a character right there. And Dan, as we all know, gets it wrong a lot, but he's not, this man is not a crackpot. And I have a lot of respect for him. And the his methodology is very interesting. So, all right, here is my conversation with William Deere. Again, he believes that OJ is innocent and he can prove it. William Deere, Bill, do me a favor, tell me where you were born.
I was born in Miami, Florida.
Into what kind of family?
A working class family. It's a great mother and dad. My father died. My mother raised us. And so we all pitched together. Then I stayed there and did a lot of work for different places, grocery stores and things like that to help my mother. Then when I became 18, graduated from high school, I was invited to join the Florida Highway Patrol. In the communication division until I was 21, of which that time then they were going to put me into a class and then on the road.
I'm sorry, communications like dispatch and that kind of thing. And then
yeah, I was a dispatcher, but then when I became 20, a constable had asked if I would be willing to have my age changed to 21 so that I could be his chief deputy, and I agreed to do so. And so during those days in Miami, Florida, constable's the one that served all the warrants for murders and things like that. It was a very exciting life. It wasn't what I planned, but it was interesting.
See, you were at 21. You became a deputy constable, or
yeah, I became deputy constable at 20. The age change made me 21 by the court, and then I stayed there for a number of years and. decided there must be a better way to make a living. So I joined the sheriff's office from that point and worked through Miami. I guess they call it Metro now, but it was the Dade County Sheriff's Office. And I worked for them for about 4 or 5 years.
And, what did you do there?
I was a deputy sheriff.
And, you know, I'm a little confused to this day, sheriff departments versus traditional police departments, urban police departments. What is the difference?
The difference is that a police department like Miami Police Department would handle anything in the Miami area. The sheriff's office would take over outside in the county. On the other hand, they're the only ones who can come in to the city and make arrests, but the city cannot come out and make the arrest unless there's a constable.
And so I worked. Sorry, go ahead.
So I worked that for a number of years. And then as a deputy sheriff, I worked through the Bay of Pigs invasion, learned how it is that law enforcement worked, a lot different than it is today. But I got tired of eating at the back door of every restaurant. I made my mind up that I was going to move one day and I was going to change my life and walk into the front door of every restaurant that I had to eat at the back garbage pit area. And I did. I've done that. Moved to Miami. I moved from Miami to Dallas, worked for a police department for a short period of time, then opened up my own company.
Can I ask you this? What do you mean by eating in the back of a restaurant, back door of a restaurant?
Well, in other words, the police departments or sheriff's office, in the patrol areas that you'd have some major restaurants, and they offered the free food, but we had to eat in the very back by the garbage pit areas where some of the help would eat. And so it wasn't the most pleasant place, but they were really nice restaurants. The food was good and people treated me good. That's all I cared about.
Was the money, were you struggling financially?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, during those days, you didn't make much money as a policeman. I ended up, we had what was called the numbers racket. Which is Bolito, that's what it was called at the time. And I wouldn't participate in it, but a number of deputies did. And I ended up being punished and sent to Miami National Airport and did a punishment tour there for 3 months. And that's when I ended up giving Jimmy Hoffa, I guess you know who Jimmy Hoffa is. Anyway, I gave him a ticket for parking and wouldn't move his car. And so I used to get in a lot of trouble. So they moved me back to Perrine, Florida, which was also a suburb of Miami in the county. And I worked in the people of color area predominantly, delivered babies, gunshots, wounds, things like that. So I picked up a great deal of experience before I was really 25 years old.
And real quick, you mentioned Bay of Pigs. How did that impact you?
Well, it did. I mean, we were offered a number of the deputies and I were offered a great deal of money to help train and out in the area that we were working for the Bay of Pigs. And then XYZ dollars if we would go. I chose not to go. I felt it was a fiasco because of the fact that too many people knew what we were doing and when we were coming. So some of my friends went on with it because they needed that kind of money. I think it was like $15,000. And then several friends of mine were brought back in the bottom of a boat and bodies were riddled with bullets. So I was glad I wasn't part of them.
And I take it this was CIA sponsored training?
I assume so. I don't know. I just got paid and that was it. I worked in addition to my job as a deputy sheriff, I ended up helping train some of those people. I saw what was going on with the CIA during that particular time. Nearly got killed because of them. Interesting, but again, Miami, Florida was a place that, you know, when the Cuban invasion came, a lot of the big guys and bad guys would come there. The same way when I was at Miami National Airport, we had a file that was probably 6 inches thick that listed all the mob figures. A lot of the mob figures would have their families living in Fort Lauderdale, which was Broward County. And but then they would leave and go back to New York, places like where you live, Chicago, Detroit, and do whatever thing they were going to do there. So when they came in, we would talk to them, say, whatever. It was more of the detectives doing that than I. But I got to stick around and learn a lot.
Why did you pick Dallas? Why did you want to go there?
My mother and dad had moved from Miami to Dallas, and I thought Dallas seemed like a great place. It was a good starting point for me. So I had several police departments offer me positions here in the Metroplex area. I took one of them and was a policeman for a while, and then went with an investigation company for about 6 months, and I said, I'm going to open my own. And that's when I opened a private investigation company, and I licensed the state of Texas, which is C-000139, which I'm the 39th person to be licensed to as a licensed professional private investigator, licensed of the state.
What year is this that you moved to Texas?
I think it was 1962. I think it was around 1962.
Did you do any investigative work related to the Kennedy assassination?
I was standing when Kennedy drove by. I was standing on the corner of Ross and Harwood. At that point, I wasn't involved in it in any way. It wasn't until 18 years later that I was asked to be in charge of the exhumation of Oswald. And so that was an interesting part of my career, but it became part of my career as an private investigator and owning my own company. So we suspicioned that it might not be Oswald. A lot of people did. And then on Sunday during the, I think it was the Washington Redskins were playing the Dallas Cowboys. And so we met at the funeral home, Little Bethel or whatever. And there was a bunch of people from funeral homes, and they made a point. They came out and said, now look, if the casket or the vault, which they put the casket into normally, is cracked, do not say anything about it. Well, that's not something you tell me. I didn't take orders from them or anybody. This to me was to be done right. And so I had a good reputation standby. So when I went down into the grave, I found the vault was cracked. And we had the whole place surrounded by police officers. You had Oswald's wife, Maria, and people like Eddowes from England, who wrote a book that wouldn't be Oswald in the grave. I think we had 400 or 500 people there that were surrounded. And I was able to have my staff keep them separated. And we were hoping to get in and out because we arrived at, I think it was at 11 o'clock at night, left the cemetery. I was told to go pick up the man who did the embalming of Oswald. And so I picked him up along with his assistant who was there at the time. And that's when I was driving back and I heard the guy holler and say, they were actually talking to themselves. And I heard him say something, and I jammed on the brakes, and I turned around, and I said, what was that I heard you say? And they wouldn't tell me, and I said, I'm not going another step further in this car until you tell me. And he said that he was offered $25,000, I think it was, for Oswald's trigger finger. And my comment was, let's hope you're telling me right now, is his finger intact? And he said, yes, but, and that's all I wanted to hear. So I got him back there, and they went, did their thing. I did mine. We went down. Oswald's body was in very bad shape. We took it and slid it from the casket that had been inside the vault, which had deteriorated badly, and slid into a cardboard box, and then took it over to Baylor Hospital. And that's where they were trying to determine whether the head would be attached to the spinal column. If it wasn't, then they felt it wouldn't be Oswald. My position was that even if it had not been attached, that Russia was well known to be able to be very good at substituting bodies, heads, and while they were alive, and doing their changeover, make them look entirely different. But when we got the body back to the Baylor Hospital, the head was attached to the spinal column because I was there when we removed his head.
Wait, so you personally laid eyes on his corpse?
Oh, yeah.
There's
pictures of me. There's pictures of, and what happened was when we ended up, as we brought the body up, apparently the news media had gotten hold of it, as you know how that happens. And suddenly thousands of people, before actually it was nearly dawn, were surrounded on the fence, on the outside of the fence. And as we went down and brought the body up, they broke through the fence and ran for the ground where we had brought up Oswald. And there's a picture of a woman, young woman, jumping into the gravesite and pulling out part of the wooden casket. And
that's crazy. So I remember this. I remember it was in 80 or 81, 81, I believe. Can I just ask you two things about that? Number one, what court ordered that and for what purpose? I know there was an amazing amount of interest in who was Oswald, you know, agent, all that stuff. Did he do it? But what entity ordered the exhumation? And I assume they had to get family permission.
I think it was Dallas County. I think it was the one that had to give the permission to exhume the body. And then it was turned over to us to handle the exhuming of the body. It was stated for a long period of time they didn't feel it would be Oswald in the grave, that it would be some Russian agent. And so that rumor consisted of several books, a lot of articles, a lot of stories, until all those many years later that the body was brought up and taken over to justify the fact of, is it Oswald, is it not Oswald? And I can assure you that it was Oswald, because I'm the one that, when they put him back, we put him back in a metal casket this time instead of a wooden. And my staff and I took him back and put him down into the grave, lowered him down into the grave along with the funeral people.
How long was he out of the ground? How many hours?
I would think, when we came out, it would have been about 6 in the morning. I imagine at least 8 hours, because they took a lot of the stuff that cuts the odor down and poured it all over his body.
And you're aware of the controversy over the wooden casket, like, was retained by the funeral home, and they tried to sell it a few years ago. Did you know about that? Somebody did.
Oh, yeah. And I think the brother, Oswald's brother, I think it was able to file suit and get possession of it.
Yeah.
I don't know whatever happened to the casket. I filed it for a while, but I was angry because of the mortician, what he had done, the fact that I was going to be put in a bad situation if the trigger finger was missing, and then the fact that people wanted souvenirs. And I mean, they were going crazy all over that. I thought most of them would be waiting to watch the Dallas Cowboys play, so I wasn't so concerned. Several helicopters came over that were camera crew. One guy actually fell out of the helicopter coming over the top of where I was, and I thought he was coming straight down, and luckily he had on a harness, and he only fell out about 8 or 10 feet.
He was just totally fascinating that you had this experience. One other quick thing on this, Oswald, so nobody, you're satisfied, nobody got any souvenirs other than the casket, right?
That's all that I knew of. I was there when they finished, put the head back, put it in a new, funeral home wanted, they offered to supply a new casket, because that one's wood, and it was supposed to be in metal originally. And so they agreed that they would furnish the new casket, and that way they would determine how long it would take for a casket to maybe deteriorate at the time. So the agreement was made between the funeral people and the casket people. But all I cared about, we put him back into the funeral hearse and then brought him back. And there's pictures of myself where we go and lower him back down into the grave.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. You did very well as a private investigator. That's what I've kind of been able to kind of gather.
I've done very well. I've been very successful. I've worked kidnappings all over the world. I've done murders all over the world.
What is your bread and butter? What is your firm? What did you do the most of?
Early on, we did a lot of investigation work. And then later on, after my reputation became what it was, I was asked to do more kidnappings. And then solving murders. So that became most interesting to me, and that's something I enjoyed because it was very difficult to do. But again, we didn't have the opportunity of having DNA during that time. We didn't have a lot of lab work. But I will tell you something that did happen, and I'm trying to remember when it did. I got a call from a major company that owns office supply stores across the country. And apparently their attorney called and said they had been at the Knoll. And one of them had
I'm sorry, at the grassy knoll?
At the grassy knoll. Yeah. And that somebody felt a clump and reached down and picked it up and wiped it off, and it was a bullet casing. And they called me and didn't want any part of it, but I agreed that I would take it if they would give me a signed statement releasing it and how they found it. And it turned out that the bullet casing was prior to the assassination. Whether it was one of those or not, because I know there were two shooters. There was Oswald and another guy. When we take that, I think I still have that bullet casing, but took it to Miami, Florida, where my friend was now, used to be my writing partner, and he became head of the sheriff's office, or Metro, I think, at that time. And they had a fabulous collection of shells, cartridge shells. So we started to, I'd flown in my plane with my pilot and I and another guy, and we were checking the bullet casing when we were got a call to him, and he said, "Bill, we got to get you out of here. The feds are coming, and they want that bullet casing." So we slipped out the back door. I made it to my plane in Opa-locka, and I still have it.
Do the feds still want it?
I don't know whether they do or not, but I have it.
Okay. Listen, do me a favor overall, and then we'll talk the pressing case. But what is the difference between a private investigator and traditional law enforcement? I know that there are a lot of advantages when you're a private investigator, but there have to be some limitations and some challenges as opposed to being in law enforcement, credentialed law enforcement. So tell us a little bit about the difference, if you would.
Well, a lot of times I'm pro-policeman unless I see the police department as corrupt in some way. I do not have the powers to arrest. I don't have the powers to subpoena. But normally if I'm working with the police department, like in the Milo murder up in Ohio, where we made 11 arrests and 11 convictions, we worked as a team. I can do things they can't do. They're more budget restrained than I am. And so I can contact people that they can't contact. I can offer rewards that they normally won't do. So in the Milo case, where I was inducted in the Police Officers Hall of Fame as a private investigator, there was a great deal of teamwork, and that's why we were able to get it done. I'm working one right now, a major one that you know of, but I'm not going to really go into it, that the police chief will not work with me or anybody. And it's been unsolved for 8 years. So I'm now taking it. And as I tell people when I go in to do a murder case or something like that, if it's my nickel, it's my way. If it's not my nickel, it's still my way. Some people hire me, like at the Wax Museum in Grand Prairie, to do work, and then all of a sudden want to cover something up. Well, that doesn't happen with me. If you're involved, I'm going to bring it out, period. I have never been bought and paid for in my life. And I learned that when I was with the sheriff's office. So I'm still here and still doing it after all these many years.
So, by the way, do you have a family?
I raised two boys and I have a daughter, but I raised two boys 20 years apart, and they're very successful businessmen. My sons or my family came first. But again, I had a lot of contracts in my life for the kind of cases I was working. So the first one had a bodyguard take him to school. You know, when we lived on 28 acres in DeSoto, which is a suburb south of Dallas, he had his own private room next to his bedroom that he could push a button and slide into the attic and wait for somebody to come get him. Fortunately, we didn't have to do that, but he was prepared for murder early on. We knew how to get, my people knew how to get him out. So if I got shot or something happened, he would wait there until he knew who it was that would be able to unlock the door up on top of the roof.
Wow. Wow. All right. Fast.
Second one didn't have to go through that.
But good. Fast forward to June of 1994. The whole country, hears about the murder and the suspicion around OJ and the slow speed chase. How soon after that did you go to Los Angeles? It was almost right away, correct?
It was within 72 hours. I watched it on television, and I didn't like what I was seeing. I watched when OJ pulled back in, and I watched his son run up to the window, and that's when AC pushed him in the face and said, "Keep your damn mouth shut." And they pulled on in, and the police grabbed Jason. And next thing you know, they surrounded the Bronco and allowed OJ to come out and go into his house. And then I became involved because it became a media circus, but I wasn't satisfied with what I was hearing. It didn't make total sense to me. So I decided that I would take Chris Stewart, who had been with me many, many years. And we flew out and went to Rockingham. I mean, you couldn't even get there.
Before we get to that, tell me a little bit about what you were seeing that you did not like, that really rubbed you the wrong way. That's a big, because it's an active investigation, and you say, this is not going right. What did you see?
Well, I immediately saw what the police were doing, and I felt it was a rush to judgment. I don't see how they could have checked out all these other witnesses. Luckily, I had checked on something very quickly and found that his son, Jason Lamar Simpson, was on probation at the time for assaulting his previous employer with a knife. And yet they never interviewed him. It never brought out. It was just a rush to judgment. It's OJ. He cut his finger, and they found the glove behind the bungalow. And I just felt it didn't match up with what I was seeing.
So you knew before you actually went to L.A., you knew about Jason Simpson.
I knew that I had concerns. If Jason was not interviewed, how many other people were not interviewed?
Right. If you don't mind.
And I just thought.
You had to get there. How many children did O.J. Simpson have?
Well, he had Jason and Arnell, Sydney and Justin. And so he had a total of four, two by her and two by Marguerite, which was his high school sweetheart.
And the other one that you wrote about, who did not make it to her two-year-old birthday.
Aaron, yes, that's very sad to me. That was another thing that concerned me. I found that he had this 23-month-old daughter that drowned in the swimming pool. And supposedly Jason was supposed to be watching her while Arnell was up front washing the car. It was on a Sunday. And apparently Jason walked off, left the child there. She fell in the pool. And actually, you know, they find her in the bottom of the pool. I have my feelings on that one. But Jason was very young at the time. I knew from what I gathered, he was very jealous. I pulled up an article from the Sports Illustrated, where OJ was interviewed and said that I may have to quit football to stay home and take care of my son, Jason. That concerned me. Then we start pulling records and documents and things. I have a good database. I have one of the finest databases in the country.
And you go with Chris shortly after you get there. Well, yes. you went to Rockingham first. And what was your assessment?
Oh, we just
of
drove up to drove by Rockingham, bumper to bumper. It took us nearly 2 hours to get in and get out, and that was enough of that circus. And so I went over to where the murder occurred, and there was nobody there. I drove through the alley, and there was a "Do Not Enter" sign there in the back of her condo, and four or five bushes that had been pushed up on the back gate. And but there was no guard, no nothing. And so I decided that we'd come back late that night. And I dropped Chris off on the corner of Dorothy and Bundy. And Tony and I was headed out that if I got arrested, call my attorney and get me out. And so I walked down to Dorothy and turned right into the alley. And came up behind where the "Do Not Cross" sign was, and the flowers, and moved the flowers and up, or the plants. They were tall, and I climbed over the back gate and walked that walkway. And I had been concerned that they act like they didn't know who had done it. And I thought the front door, from what I could gather, had a picture window to the right, and I was right. So I walked that walkway, and I got up one step, down another, and approached her door. And I looked at the steps, and there was blood still all over the steps. But I realized that Nicole would have had to have seen who it was. If she did and she was afraid, why did she open the door? And so I sat there for a few minutes and then felt that there's much more to this story than was being told.
One thing you noticed right off the bat, Bundy on television, you can't tell whether it's a busy street or not a busy street. It's a very busy street, and the murder happened pretty close to the big street, right?
Correct. Yeah, you've got Bundy is you came through San Vicente, which is where OJ supposedly was hit, nearly collided with another person who we have good contact with. It's a very busy intersection. Dorothy's, I'm trying to remember, when you pull into the alleyway and you pass Nicole's on the right, it dead ends to, I'm sorry, I can't remember. I should know it, and it'll come to me. And then you had to turn to the right or to the left. You turn to the right, you'd end up at Bundy. Right there would be the intersection of Bundy.
So, look, I want to ask you something, and then we'll go into the specifics of Justin, but I just want to, or Jason, I always mix him up with the other child, Justin.
Justin's a good guy.
Yeah, yeah. He's a realtor in Florida and living his best life, it looks like. Thanks to your work, I have serious doubts about OJ's involvement in any of this. I really do think he's innocent. But I almost want to take it further. I find it very hard to believe, and granted, I'm not finished with your book, and I'm not finished with everything, and there's so much out there. I'm not convinced that OJ was there that night. You say he was, and I want to ask you something. I mean, I think I know the answer, but forgive me for asking you. It was part of that a marketing decision? Was part of that because people can accept, you can take them through, he didn't do it, but they won't accept that he wasn't at least there. You have to meet them halfway. And I'm not saying consciously that affected your decision, but, and you know more about this than I ever will, but just looking at it.
I'll be honest with you, and I don't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah.
It didn't make one difference to me what people thought. I didn't give a damn. It was my money. I was paying for this investigation. And as a result, I was going to tell it the way I saw it. Either I did not intend at that time to get that much involved. I wanted to find out. So I could have flown back to Dallas, which I did. But when I determined in my mind that, and I was convinced afterwards, and based on a lot of things, that OJ had come to the scene, but after the murders. And if that's the case, he was protecting somebody. I ended up with an eyewitness who helped confirm what I saw. There was an individual who was a private investigator, licensed in the state of California, with no problems in his licensing. And he was observing what was going down the alleyway. And his comment was to me, Mr. Deary, he said, I was on another assignment. And he said, a car came off of Bundy. It was a Bronco. He said, the headlights went off, caused my attention. It turned to the right off of Dorothy, right onto the alleyway, and continued down so far, and I pulled up my binoculars, and I could see there were two people in there. And the vehicle stopped with the headlights off and still running. I could see the exhaust coming. And he said that he continued to watch. Door opened. He recognized OJ. OJ got out, walked around, was putting on a pair of gloves as he was coming around the back. And he came around the back, and the passenger then climbed over the console and was behind the vehicle that was still running. He later recognized who it was, and he recognized that it was Jason. So OJ went inside from the rear and came out 10 or 15 minutes later. In that time, when he entered, he was fully dressed except for putting on the gloves. When he came out, he didn't have anything on but his underwear. And had these clothes rolled up in a bundle under his left arm and reached to the right, opened the door, and climbed in. That's why I surmise that some of the blood that was on the clothes, hit the console or made it onto the console. I know in my own mind that OJ had gone up there based on what Jason had told him. And as a result, he sees her laying in a fetal position. He takes the glove off. When he does, he reaches down and checks her, and eyes are wide open. The head goes one way, and the body kind of rolls, and it shocks him. He drops the glove. The body rolls two steps down. He's got blood on him to some degree. He looks up, and there's Ron Goldman against the fence, laying on his portion on his back. They're both dead. He was more concerned for his two children up top because at the recital earlier that evening, she had said that they were going to go to Jackson's restaurant to eat after the recital.
No. I understand. If you don't have that witness, and by the way, I totally, everything's plausible, but if that witness, that private eye who was on another job, if he mm-hmm. didn't exist, is what happens to your case?
wouldn't have made any difference to me, because I felt that I was able to piece it together without any problem whatsoever, because of the fact that when OJ came through the intersection of San Vicente and nearly was struck, he was returning to his home in Rockingham. And when he did, oh my God, I know that woman's name and I can't even think of it.
It begins with an A or something like that, a Cervente.
Oh my God.
I'll find it for you.
Anyway, she gets in touch.
Shipley?
No. Shively.
Shively. Close.
Shively. Her name was Shively. Anyway, OJ's coming through the intersection. He kind of runs the light. She jams on her brake. He passes by and she sees him. And he kept on going, which would have got him into Rockingham. And, you know, at that point, he was alone.
She apparently accepted money or something. That's why they didn't use her.
I tested her and she passed. She receive money, but you have to know you're dealing with Marcia Clark. I don't know if you know much about Marcia Clark, but did you know that she was previously married to Gabe Horowitz?
You know, that sounds familiar. I met Marcia Clark once when she, but look, we'll get, if you don't mind, just one other thing about the individual, the witness, the private eye. Why didn't he go to the police or to the prosecutor?
He was scared to death. He thought it was a drug situation. He didn't come out he didn't contact me for quite some period of time.
But why wouldn't he have done it then after he knew it wasn't drugs? I mean, why wouldn't he have?
He was scared to death. He just, he was married, had no children. Just he and her. And when it started hitting out and my book came out, he read it. And then that's when he called and I met him in confidence. And we gave him a polygraph test by the top polygraph examiner in the country. And then we polygraphed him a second time and he cleared. And people, when we did that show in 2016, they couldn't believe he passed and it shocked him, but he did pass it. And I felt more comfortable at that point. I was dubious. As to what he was telling me. But again, it made sense. I had other people who were helping me that gave me certain stories that they would not give to the police. A great deal of people came forward to give me information that did not want to become involved with the police department.
But people give stories to the police department all the time as well that don't check out.
When it comes to something such as this, departments are... they've got their hand out for information. They have their informants or CIs. So do I. And when I was able to determine that, hey, I'm looking at it differently, the police department, just like, well, we won't go into that until you're ready, but Van Aaron Lang, you've got Ron Goldman. I know a lot about Ron Goldman. I don't care what his mother or his father says. And his mother, they're divorced, but I knew a great deal about Ron Goldman and started making a lot of sense.
So let's talk, if you don't mind. Jason Simpson. Jason Simpson was how old in June of 1994? 23, 24?
He was 25. He was 5'11", 25 years old, weighed 235 pounds, and was working at Jackson's Restaurant at 8908 Beverly Boulevard in Beverly Hills.
And how far is that from Bundy, roughly?
12 minutes.
Oh, wow. All right. So, and tell us a little bit about Jason. He grows up, son of O.J. Simpson, famous guy. What kind of childhood did he have that we know of?
He was a very troubled child. He did drugs, alcohol, he failed in football. He never could amount to what his dad had been. He got scholarship only because of his father, but it didn't materialize. He ended up wanting to be a chef. His grandfather was a chef. OJ's father was a chef. And so that's what his goal was. He wanted to do that. And so he worked at a number of restaurants. The trouble is he couldn't hold down the job very long. When we started checking into him, we found that he'd been in a psychiatric unit. We found that he checked into Cedars-Sinai Hospital 2 months prior to the murders, told the attending physician, the doctor, I'm about to rage. I'm out of my medication, Depakote. And he suffers from intermittent rage disorder. He attempted suicide 3 different times. We knew from that point, we started looking at him closely. And I didn't give up on OJ. I continued to look at OJ to make sure that I was in the right ballpark. I don't just jump out and say somebody is guilty without looking at it or innocent. We knew that Jason had had problems that he ever had worked at. We knew that he had attacked his previous girlfriend and cut off all her hair with a chef knife. We knew he threw one girl into a tub that had no water in it. Another one he dragged, bashed out his car window and pulled out of the window when she ran from where they were having his birthday.
And in your book, by the way, you have the police report or some sort of document that confirms, but in your book, it's there. If we can focus on the assault, the assault with a deadly weapon. Who was that guy, Paul somebody, and what happened?
His name was Paul Goldberg. He was the owner of the Revival Cafe. When we did our show in 2016, we tracked him down. I tracked him down earlier, but he wanted to be paid at that time, and I wouldn't do it. So later on, we did meet with him. He came back from country where he was staying. We filmed him and he showed me how that Jason beat the crap out of him, and he thought he was going to die. He said, Jason grabbed me. I had fired him and he took me out back, pulled me around the side, started stomping on me and kicking on me. And he said, I thought he was going to kill me. And the only thing that saved my life is that, there was a voice, a woman's voice that said, stop, Jason, stop. You're going to kill him. And said he stopped, but he said he had lost it mentally, you know?
And this is so key. This is so. And the night of the murder, that Jason Simpson is actually on probation for that offense,
right?
and you mentioned the psychiatric trouble, and you have documentation of that.
And then keep in mind, they never interviewed him. How could you not? It's 101 basics. If you're getting up and announcing that you've investigated all these people and whatever, and you never interviewed his son, who's on probation for assault with a deadly weapon, a knife. That didn't make a bit of sense to me. And it angered me, and believe it or not, because to me, I interviewed Ron Shipp, who had known the family for many, many years. Jason was a troubled kid. Everybody knew it. He'd been a troubled kid for a long time, since he was 10 years old. And, okay, I don't know. Go ahead and ask your question.
No. So that was the night. That is a huge piece of evidence. He's never interviewed. And
we proved that by Lieutenant Pietroni. We contacted LAPD. They sent it back. I had attempted to contact the district attorney's office, and I've got where I wrote the correspondence, wanted to visit, but they wouldn't do it. I was very fortunate, though. In England, there was a company coming in that was going to film the OJ case. And they asked me if I would be an advisor on it. I did, with the understanding that I could make copies of everything. They apparently gained access to the storage facility where all the documented evidence was. And so I was able to photograph what I need and review all the files that have been in the trial.
Amazing, amazing. That's so clever of you. Now, by the way, he was questioned by Daniel Petrocelli during the civil lawsuit.
Civil
and if you look through that, and I know you have, and it's videotape, but the transcription is out there. It's pretty amazing. I mean, they seem to be very suspicious of him. Did the bell start going off for them?
Petrocelli's own law partner said, quote, if I didn't know that Jason Simpson didn't have an airtight alibi, I would have considered him to be the one who committed the murder. This came from Petrocelli's own man in their book.
You know, but the thing is, even in that, I don't think he had an airtight alibi. He says
he didn't.
Right. I mean, that's almost like fake news within the moment. He said he left that restaurant at 10 o'clock.
Lie.
All right. So what happened on tell us about Jason Simpson's day, June 12th, and the weekend, the days leading up to June 12th. What's going on with Jason Simpson?
Alan Ladd Jackson owned Jackson's restaurant. He partnered with several others, a silent partner, but he was the dominant partner who ran the restaurant as a chef. And so he was taking off that Sunday, and Jason was normally the sous chef, but on Sunday night, there are normally not many people. The next day, when the police department caught it, Alan had given Jason an airtight alibi that he's cooking in front of 200 people and that there was no way he could have been involved. I then decided I'd find out, went into the restaurant, and was able to determine that Sunday night they had only 33 or 35 people there. The cooking situation there was where Jason was in charge, and they closed the grill early because of lack of people. We knew that Jason was preparing a meal for 13 people and had really gone to a lot of trouble. He was expecting Nicole and her family all to come to Jackson's. Later, it was determined that instead she went to Messaluna.
Wait, it was they had talked. They were going to come a special occasion post recital. Yeah. Nicole told him personally, "We're coming to your restaurant, and we look forward to it." Right?
Yes, Jason said that she called him later and changed her mind, but that's not true. We checked, and she apparently did not call him. And so you don't do that to somebody who's suffering rage disorder, who's taking Depakote or not taking it, who does drugs and alcohol. And so that set him off because he embarrassed. He does not, when you read his medical records, he does not like to be embarrassed by women. I mean, purposely. I don't know what you attribute that to, but he'd had trouble with women before, as I said earlier.
Well, nobody likes being embarrassed by anybody, but when you have a rage disorder, watch out, right?
Yeah, watch out. And so as a result, he drops Jennifer Green off in his Jeep, and then he goes over from there and comes in, parks his vehicle in the back, comes in the back way. He had access to her place. He knew where the key was. She was expecting Ron Goldman and to come over to drop off her mother's keys or her glasses or whatever. But she was also expecting Goldman to be there for other reasons. And so he comes up, knocks on the door. She sees him. She opens the door. The two children were upstairs, but asleep. And again, nobody didn't know that at the last minute, at the revival, these two children were having a sleepover that night. And OJ didn't know it changed. It didn't change until the last minute once they got home. And so the two children were up right above, you know, the living room. When he confronts her, as she comes out, she opens the door. He carries a boot knife, a Gerber replica Mark V, designed for one purpose, to cut and to kill.
No, wait, how do we know he carries that?
Because he told other people that, and other people we interviewed got it. And I have the murder weapon. I mean, I have that weapon. And it's a boot clip that can fit on your boot or it can fit on your belt. And he made several statements. I'd go unless I had my knife. So we know he had the knife. If she came out and she was waiting for Goldman, she wanted him out of there. And now, they keep in mind that they'd gone out, from what we gathered from friends that I had talked to. They'd gone dancing before and they'd gone out to eat before. But this night, you know, it was different. She was expecting somebody else. And so they got in an argument. And so I can just foresee what I know in my mind was said. As a German woman, she's been caught before for slapping the maid. I think she slapped him. She set it off, and he pulls out his knife.
Wait a second. Wait, she was actually born in Germany. Did she spend her formative years in Germany?
I don't know. I just know that they all referred to her as a woman who could lose her temper in a second. A German woman said that many, many times to me. So if that was the case, she slapped him. You don't slap a man who does drugs, that's been stood up, who's out of his medication, and then expect somebody not to lose their temper. Well, in my mind, he lost his temper. And by that time, Ron Goldman's coming in the back, and he had already pulled the knife, and so he struck her on top of the head with the butt of the knife. And you have to see the knife to know. I have the knife, and the top of the knife had been removed, and wax had been poured in. But when you match the hilt of that knife to the laceration sustained by Nicole on her forehead, I mean, on top of her head, scalp, it matched perfectly. Two of the top medical examiners said there's no doubt in their mind this was a murder weapon. And then you say, well, how did I get it? And that's a question you just have to ask me. I normally don't go into greater detail than what we're doing today. But I'm trying to help you in any way.
No, well, I appreciate it so much, and I'm personally fascinated by it. And well, if you don't mind, let's just continue because I'm very curious about how OJ gets involved after Justin does what you think he did, and so he's like, oh, oh my God, what have I done? There's that moment, right?
Yeah, that's when you have to read his deposition, he'll sometimes say, excuse me, not his deposition, the medical record. He'll say, sometimes I don't realize what I've done. And I think this is the case. What happened was that he struck her in the head. She fell down. And when she did, her watch struck the pavement. Okay. It was a whatever that watch that he's on the board of directors. Anyway, so when she hit the ground, the watch, her left hand hit the concrete.
Was it a Swiss Army watch?
Swiss Army watch. You'll have to help me a little bit. No problem. Back. Her hand hit the ground, and when it did, it caused the watch to stop. Marsha Clark made a big point about the watch, and I'll tell you when we talk further. And so Ron Goldman comes in. Now, when he had struck Nicole, that wasn't a serious wound. It rendered her unconscious, but it wasn't one that she would not have recovered from with some stitches. Goldman comes in. They start fighting. Ron Goldman doesn't have a weapon. Jason does, in my mind, based on my investigation. They fight. Goldman gets 27 stab wounds, ends up falling to the ground, kicks his feet up, and the knife blade comes across the bottom of his tennis shoe. It's a double-bladed knife, very razor sharp on both sides, been sharpened more than one occasion, and so he's now dead. Then all of a sudden, Nicole's starting to come to, and that's when, in my mind, based on the investigation, he puts his foot on her back, pulls her head back, and cuts her three times with a knife. Then he drops her, and that's when she starts bleeding out. Then he calls his father. I don't know what I've done, Dad. I don't know what I've done.
Okay, this is the part. This is the key part. How does he call his father?
I don't know that exactly. I know that he got in touch with him. And there's no doubt in my mind that they met at this intersection. There's a grocery store and a service station on the corner, San Vicente and Bundy. And I think he told Jason to meet him there. He pulled in where they parked in the back. It's dark.
Can I just ask you this? We know about O.J. He made a call at 10:03. According to F. Lee Bailey, I don't know this, but F. Lee Bailey in his book wrote that O.J. called Paula Barbieri at 10:03.
Yeah, right.
So, that's a local call. I mean,
I don't know if that was a local. Paula Barbieri was not a local call, I didn't think.
They're both
the record someplace.
They're both in the 310 area code. But my question is, like, this is where we don't have, there's no data. There should be, right? I mean, there is a detailed call record. They can get that, or can they not get it for local calls? I mean, how do we?
I understand when we checked, you couldn't get it from local calls.
Yeah, that could be.
So to me, okay, that gives you a prime example. If he talked to her at 10:03, I saw the records on that one too from Paula. But I do know that he left there, and in my mind, he went over there, and that's when our witness sees him pull up and get in and come back out. But he did not commit the murder. The murder already occurred. And that's when he pulls out, or Jason then went to the end of the road where it dead ends, and before it turns to the right. And I think that Jason drove across. And O.J. got back into the proper seat of the driver, and Jason gets into his car, and O.J. tells him, keep your damn mouth shut.
Now, let me ask you this. What is the purpose in Jason's mind? Why would he want O.J. to come over there? He knows they're dead. Like, what purpose is served by bringing his father to the scene?
Very simple. You're crying for help. He's been crying for help all his life. When he gets into a problem, he always calls for his dad. His dad was the one that was paying for the Depakote at Brentwood Pharmacy. And then after the murders, his father said, I'm not paying for it anymore. And I have those prescriptions. I have the note.
But why, like, okay, I've run to my parents before when I've been in trouble. I mean, like, but I wouldn't bring them to the scene of the crime.
Commit a murder either.
Yeah. And actually, I guess OJ maybe you did what now? And wanted to see it or something.
Probably didn't totally believe him. I think he was more concerned with his two children upstairs at that particular point. He loved those kids. He loved Justin and Cindy dearly. And I think he was worried that maybe something had gone, sad wrong. Maybe the kids were standing there looking at the bodies. And so that's when he agreed to come over. I can picture Jason calling him. I can picture OJ saying, hey, look, I don't believe what you're saying, but I'll meet you. Let's go over there. And I want to see for myself. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, he's a father. I don't give a damn. He's a father. And that has to be important. He realizes that he played football all his life when he should have been taking care of the kids. Arnell was much stronger than Jason. Jason was a weak sort of person, had a lot of problems in school, had a lot of problems with drugs. Arnell did not. And so I think in that particular case, he wanted to see for himself. Are my two kids okay upstairs? So he goes, gets in the car, picks up Jason, drives over there, confirms they're dead. My witness backs that up. OJ comes out with the clothes wrapped around in a bundle, and OJ heads back and nearly gets hit by Jill Shively. If you say she's accurate, I take it she's accurate. We tested her, and it sounded okay to me, and nobody had any discrepancies there with her. I know that she paid, and Marcia Clark, though, you have to understand Marcia Clark. Marcia, you do it Marcia Clark's way, or you don't do it at all, okay? She's got a foul mouth. She knows it. Everybody else that's worked with her knows that. It's her way or the highway.
Can we talk about can we talk about Ron Goldman for a second, though? You say sure. You know why he was there. I mean, look, whether it was drugs or sex, I mean, it doesn't really matter. Is there something else that was going on that's important?
I know in my mind that you have to know Ron Goldman. We knew after investigation to plant that Goldman was a UC, an undercover for the police department. He had been arrested a couple of times and nearly went. He was dealing drugs in high school, and he knew full well that he was going to go down hard. So I think that from what we gather, he had given information in from the school or whatever to keep himself out of jail. He wasn't a nice guy. He burglarized his mother. Burglarized his father's house to get money. He stiffed the paper boy. He cheated the pizza delivery guy. We knew that Messaluna, in fact, I interviewed two doctors from Dallas, and they admitted to me that they used to buy their cocaine from Messaluna. It was operated by Keith Zomovich, who was just the front man for it. Ron Goldman worked there. There's no doubt what Ron Goldman was doing on a sideline. Like I said, Mr. Goldman's a nice person. His daughter is a nice person. I don't have any respect for Ron whatsoever. I know too much, and I don't really want to discuss much about Ron.
I understand. Just a couple of items, though, before. All right. So what about, and I know this is not central, but OJ's demeanor was observed to be by multiple people calm.
Right.
And, totally situation appropriate from the limo ride to the guy on the people on the plane.
Yeah, but you didn't hear this one. When Ron Goldman, when OJ came out, he carried a smaller bag. And Ron Parks, put the suitcase in the back. He reached for the bag and OJ told him, said, no, I'll take care of this. He puts it in the back seat. As they're en route to the airport, Parks told me that he said, it's awful hot back here, and he rolled the window out. So when he got to check-in and the guy was checking in his bag, he didn't have that black bag any longer.
Was there enough? You think there was enough time? I mean, some people say, you're throwing in a bit more time. He would need more time. Okay, there's a killing, and then OJ's got to come over and then go there and come back. Like, the time all works out for you, for OJ to have gone
It works out absolutely perfect for me. I have no trouble. We've gone over it so many times, and I like people to take an issue with me. And so I've had some of the best in the world help me to lay out my timeline. It's the same thing with Marcia Clark. Marcia Clark said that the murders occurred between 10:20 and 10:35. Baloney. Let me tell you something. I have a picture of the watch on Nicole's wrist. The watch stopped at 9:59.9. Okay.
Well, about the watch, and I'm not debating you, but this question did occur to me. I mean, number one, it could have been fast. It could have been slow. It could have been broken. It could have been.
It was broken. It stopped.
But perhaps it broke. Like, I don't know. I mean, some people, their watches, jewelry, their watches,
You know, I mean, have we ever gotten our hands on that watch to evaluate what happened to it? Was it broken? That kind of thing?
Yeah, it was broken. We established that. It was definitely broken.
And it was broken at that's the time of the murder then, 10 o'clock.
We don't know that. It was working prior to the murders. And then when her hand hit that concrete, there's no doubt in my mind that Swiss Army watch stopped. Because you can see on the pictures that we have of her body, you can see it's on her left wrist. You can see where the watch stopped and had not been running. And so then her sister even established the fact with our crew that when she got the watch back, that it was still not working.
Do you think the police, are they guilty of the misconduct and malpractice that the defense accused them of? Was the glove planted? Was blood planted?
Let's put it this way. I'm not going to get into accusing anybody other than I'll take Van Etter to task. Okay. But I won't take Tom Lyon to task. But I will say that there was a rush to judgment. I really mean that. I think that when they got into the house of OJ's, they'd already search and seizure had been inappropriate at that time. They didn't have a warrant. I think that, the socks that were found at the side of our bed
the bed,
OJ. Yeah. I think the gloves had been pulled out of the hamper. They laid sideways, and the vial of blood that Van Etter had in his hand, which was, I think it was 8 cc's of blood, was dripped onto the socks because an expert that worked with the FBI testified on film, one of the top experts in the country, that the blood went from side to side, which means there couldn't have been a foot in it. Now, when Van Etter gave the blood to the crime scene tech, and he pulled it out of his pocket, it was 6.5. I interviewed Thano Pride as the jail nurse for 37 years. He was getting ready to retire. And he said, Mr. Deer, I drew, I think he said 8 cc's of blood. He said, I know what to draw. He said, I've been doing it forever. He said, OJ was standing there. We checked him over. He had no blood, no cuts or bruises on him except for the finger. I tried to doctor the finger that had been cut. I drew the blood because Van Etter asked me to. I had the blood in this vial. And you got to understand the difference between a regular vial and a vial that would be contained EDTA. The blood on the socks that were found contained an enormous amount of EDTA.
Can I ask
which
you,
is used,
which is a preservative and anticoagulant, right?
Correct. You see it on a purple cap, and it's in the side of the glass.
What does a cc? What is a 1 cc of liquid look
I
like?
I don't. I'm not that medically.
Yeah.
All I know is told it was.
All right.
They may have a different terminology.
And what about Mark Furman? Is he a bad cop? You know, you remember? I mean, he's the guy.
I don't think so. I think Mark Furman wanted to be another. What's the guy that's the famous writer, crime writer?
Mickey Spillane?
No. This was somebody that worked with the LAPD or was with the LAPD.
Oh, Joseph Wambaugh?
Yes. I think he wanted to be another Joseph Wambaugh. I think he got himself. He ended up being a scapegoat. I think he made a mistake. I have to feel sorry for him, but he's been very successful since that time. He still makes a good living. I think he's still a commentator for Fox.
Can we go back to the Bronco just for a second? And I know this from you. I mean, there would be blood on the accelerator. There would be blood on the brake.
There should have been blood on the brake and blood on the accelerator.
And
Marsha Clark had screamed and hollered that the Bronco was full of blood. That's crap. The guy was brought back from Honolulu where he was on vacation, and he told us, he said, there wasn't that much blood. He said, the amount of blood that was found in that Bronco could have fit on my thumbnail.
Exactly.
No blood on the brake and no blood on the accelerator.
Do you have ruled out that the police may have put it there?
I don't think they put it there. I think OJ, when he climbed back in the car, holding that bundle of clothes, got a few drops on the console.
Okay, but when you wrote your book, you did not yet hear from the private eyewitness who saw OJ in the vicinity, correct? He came to you after the series or before the series. You write the book, and then that guy comes forward. Do I have that right?
I think so, yes.
So,
I'm not sure. Don't hold me to it. I'm not sure.
No, I mean, was there ever a point in your investigation where you thought, okay, OJ didn't do it,
and you could not prove that. I mean, to me, the least powerful part of your case, which is very powerful, is the part of OJ being there, of OJ going to the crime scene, because we don't have any phone records. We only have a theory in what this guy says. And in my mind, there would be a lot more blood in that vehicle than, and it, so I, how did you handle that before you got the witness?
Well, I handled it very easily. If Jason committed the murder and he left Jackson's restaurant, keep in mind that he cuts meat for the next day. Okay. When the sous chef is not needed, he'll prep for the next day. If he had blood on him, and he went back to the restaurant, took the clothes off, threw them in the hamper, and then went home. Now, you also have to remember that they called Jason over and over and over, and he was supposed to be at his apartment, and yet he didn't answer the phone. I think, don't hold me to this one, it was a little after 3 when Arnell told him she's dead. And if you listen to the recording and what was said by Arnell to Jason, and he was supposed to produce that recording but failed to do so. There's a lot of things he failed to do so.
All right, so at one point, and this is a big break, you obtained the box that he kept in storage. He didn't pay the storage. Somebody right. calls you, and this box exists, and the box is just incredible. It's almost like divine intervention. It's just incredible. Tell us a little bit of how you got the box.
Well, first of all, we had checked records and found that Jason had rented a storage facility at Public Storage. I understand Elsie Callings was the manager of that facility. And the unit that he rented was a fairly large unit. But inside, according to witnesses, was just this one box. And so when it came up for sale, that's how Public Storage makes a lot of money. They sell these items for storage, lack of payment. And so we had the copy that said Jason Simpson and what unit it was. So when this friend or associate bought the thing at auction, found that inside the box was dog's ashes, found that there was a jacket that Jason had worn when his father was found not guilty, and he made the speech on his father's behalf. There was pictures of Gerald Ford and the family. There were 3 diaries, Jason's personal diaries. One of them saying, "This is the year of the knife for me. I cut away my problems with a knife." And then at the bottom of the box was a knife, and the knife that I just described earlier was found at the bottom of the box. And there was, at that time, had initial scratch on it very lightly, like somebody had done it with a paper clip, and it had JS on it. So I obtained the story, all those items, and felt that they were very crucial to my investigation. I still have them to this day.
Did you, let's talk about the knife. Did you ever get it DNA tested?
I had it tested. I know that the original knife that OJ had supposedly used to commit the murder, according to the police department, was purchased at Ross Cuttery. But when they searched and got a search warrant for his house, they found the knife. It was still in the box, still had the sticker on it, and they checked it, and there was blood. On this particular case, I had the knife checked, but again, a long period of time, very difficult. We never took out the top of the wax. It had a reddish tint to it. But we knew that it matched the wounds sustained by Nicole and from Ron Goldman, according to the 2 medical experts.
Go ahead.
One of them was Dr. Vincent DeMaio, who was the author of Knife and Gunshot Wounds, recognized all over the world, as he felt that this, and we have him on film, that this was in all probability the knife used to kill Nicole.
Can I ask you, though, do you think, are we waiting on technology to figure out, do you think there's DNA evidence that is unrecoverable in that knife?
I don't know. We cut the sheath of the knife open and very carefully and checked, and there was some indication, but it wasn't strong enough for the experts to say, yes, this is definitely blood. We checked the Jeep, because I own Jason's Jeep, and we have it in my crime lab undercover. And we did our best to try and check that. But the console had been cut out repeatedly. When we watched Jason for a period of a year. When it rained, he'd run outside and take the top off so that it would rain inside. We thought that very strange. Normally, you put a top up, not taking the top down. But when we were gathering his trash, we found one particular note that was important to us. In addition to all the whiskey bottles or liquor bottles that we gathered out of the trash over a period of time, we found this rolled up piece of paper. It was totally wet. I carefully rolled it out, pressed it, brought it back to Dallas, and it was handwritten. And it indicates that Jason felt he was two people, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And he'd scribbled all over it after he had wrote this. And it's a very interesting letter that I think maybe in my book, but you can read it.
You had him under surveillance for about a year.
A couple years, on and off for 3 years, I think.
Why would you, what were you hoping to learn? Why would you do that?
Make a mistake.
Watch him make a mistake.
Well, we had, because of what we were doing, we had found that he had this dog. Again, keep in mind, we found the dog's ashes.
I'm sorry, what year is it? What year did you put him under surveillance? Is this during the trial or after the trial or what's going on?
It's a period after the trial when I started. I decided I had been operated on my back, and I decided I'm going to wait till the trial is over, watch the trial, and then if I want to get involved in it, I would. Everybody in my office didn't want me to do that, but I did it anyway. I'd started it. I wanted some answers for me more than anybody else. So I felt that this is what I wanted. Then I found, I bought some pictures from a guy. I ended up with a picture of Jason in bed with his dog. And he was wrestling and apparently playing with his dog. And Jason was wearing the knit cap that was similar to the one found at the crime scene. Well, we know that dressing your dog, you're going to get hair follicles into a knit cap. We found that the knit cap that was found at the crime scene was hair from a Negro male. He was also the hair was also from a dog. They didn't go any further with that because the DNA wasn't that strong at that particular time, or even I think it was extremely expensive and detailed and long. So, but anyway, we determined that. Now we've got a picture of Jason wearing the knit cap that we feel is the same knit cap found at the crime scene. I filed a Freedom of Information Act with the district attorney asking that could I have my experts examine? And they sent me back a letter to them. They said, we cannot find it. If and when we do find it, we'll make arrangements for you to look at it. Well, it went on month after month. I ended up heard that the LAPD Homicide Division was having a seminar at in Las Vegas. And what are they specializing in? O.J. Simpson's knit cap and the glove, along with the man who killed Robert Kennedy.
They were just showing these things as
they had their sectioned off where they had a uniformed LAPD man there. And it was more of a display exhibition. And so that was their highlight, was the Robert Kennedy assassination. They were really forced to take the clothes from Robert Kennedy out of there. But they left that. So I sent another letter back to the DA. I found it. Here's a picture of it. We took pictures of it. We took pictures of the billboard that said they had it. And they never answered me. And still to this day wouldn't answer me.
How do you, by the way, your investigative ability and two things that strike me. Number one, you found that hat. And number two, you found out where he had the storage and you were watching him so closely that as soon as he didn't pay, you were there. I mean,
right.
This is great. You're on top of it. And something tells me, you're not relying on Google. How do you do that? How do you do that? And how did you narrow it down? How do you find the store? I mean, public record search, I guess, but how do you do that?
Oh, we did every kind of public record search that was available at that time. There wasn't as many available as it is today.
Right.
A lot of my people feel that I have great intuition, but I spent a lot of money. I mean, that was my money. I hate to tell you how much. If anybody thinks I made money off the book, then it's my ass, because you don't make money off of a book. It's fun to have it out there. If it's a bestseller, you might break even and make some, but normally you would not.
And it is amazing. You have this Jason Simpson's former car.
Yes.
How did you get that? He put it up for sale. What happened?
We found that he was going, one of my men, who's Latino, been with me for many years, found that he went over to an apartment complex that it was a very inexpensive complex, but the gate was you had to have a key or something, and so he went in there several times. So we went back and found that the parking area, and there was one area that was there, and it had a cover over a vehicle. And I don't know why I did that. I really don't. I had him climb over, and then I got inside, and I lifted the cover and realized the tag matched Jason's Jeep. So I decided I climbed back over. Jason was having financial trouble. My Latino investigator contacted the guy who had the apartment and had the thing in storage and made him an offer, and didn't let him know in any way, shape, or form it had anything to do with Jason or the murders. And so we put it on a flatbed trailer and hauled it back to Dallas after we bought it.
Incredible. Incredible. All right. So here we are. Where is Jason Simpson now?
He was working in Atlanta. He lost several jobs there. He moved back about a year ago back to L.A. We followed him several times when he was in Atlanta and talked to some of the employers who were terrified to some degree of him. The people who worked there were scared of him. He had a bad temper. And so he went from one job to another, lasted another one quite a period of time where he was the chef. We picked up some of his menus. We watched where he was living. Then we got word that he was coming back to L.A. And I was hoping that L.A. would you know, come and pick him up based on my book and all the stories, that would pick him up and at least question him. But they never did it. They played like he didn't exist. And so he's back and he's working for the man he worked for originally, who was at Jackson C's. Has a great restaurant. Oh my gosh, it's got a retractable roof. Help me. It's in Santa Monica.
I
know it. But anyway, this particular chef had sent Jason to school in Paris to take a course in Paris, and when he did, he came back to work for this gentleman for a period of time. That there were some problems, and Jason left. The next thing you know, I'm involved, and he knows it, and he skedaddles to Atlanta.
Have you ever gotten an inkling that this is kind of like a family secret, a known family secret in the Simpson family, like that they're aware of this? I mean, the children, as you know, have stood by their father.
Absolutely.
They don't waver. The whole country says OJ's guilty, but, you know, do they know?
Yeah. I don't know what they know. I do know this, that Justin, who was a very was his son by Mark from Nicole, was a very successful real estate agent in Florida. About a year ago, when his father became ill, he quit his job, moved to Las Vegas to take care of his dad. And that's very loyal to me, okay, for somebody to do something like that. You didn't see Jason doing it. You saw Justin doing it. And then they were all together. In fact, OJ's going to be cremated on Tuesday, from my understanding.
So we're coming up on, do you think with OJ's death, this somehow there will be renewed attention, interest, potential momentum in this case?
I do. I got an email from somebody who called me a lot of names, which I get a kick out of. I'm not through with this case. Greg, I'm not. I have come this long. I'm going to push it and push it and push it. I got the evidence. I want a grand jury hearing. I want them to look at the evidence I have and make up their own mind. I want, you know, Carl Jones was representing Jason right after the murders. I think OJ hired him 2 days after. Carl Jones was one of the top criminal lawyers in the country. And they claimed that when I asked why they didn't interview Jason, the LAPD, they said, well, he was represented by an attorney. That's not totally true. You can pick up a person as a suspect and bring them in if it's a person of interest. You can ask them all these questions. The attorney can be present, and the attorney can tell them, take the fifth or don't answer the question.
Well, they did it to OJ. OJ had an attorney, and they actually convinced the attorney and OJ that he had to stay outside.
So what's good enough for Jason? And OJ should have been certainly good enough. And then now, with what we have, when Alan Ladd Jackson, who the manager gave him that airtight alibi, has now admitted that he should not have given him the alibi because he wasn't even there that night. He was at his mother and father's place cooking barbecue with some of the people that were connected to the restaurant and financially. And he was there the whole night, never went to the restaurant night. And how in the H can you give him an airtight alibi when you're not even there? Okay. And then one of these people furnished me a time card. And even though the time card has become in question, it was a copy of the actual time card that one of the people got their hands on it, met with me in LA, gave me a copy of it, and it shows that the time card had been altered. Come on, all these are just fitting into the puzzle.
Yeah, no. So can I ask you, the Discovery series, Investigation Discovery, was very well done. In my opinion, it might have been...
Not so much in my mind, but that's fine.
Well, I was actually going to say, it was almost too well done. It was too polished. Yeah. It was too slick. I didn't think you need those two guys. I mean, it needed to be on Netflix where they let these things breathe a bit more, you know, somewhere. But it was too stylized, and I think that got in the way of the narrative of the evidence of what was going on.
I totally agree with you. I thought they wanted to debunk me. Some of the stuff that you didn't see, I totally debunked them. How to get there that quick, you know, when Jason went from dropping Jennifer Green off and going over the crime scene and back. It was interesting. I liked Derek Levasseur, Chris Mahandy, but both were policemen. I mean, they had you got to keep in mind that one of them played in Big Brother and one Big Brother, and then now is a private investigator. And Mahandy's still doing, I think, with he's a psychologist and was a negotiator at one time. I don't stay in touch with either one of them. I liked them, but I didn't have any respect for them. I felt that with the way the show was going, they were trying to debunk me. And so what they hit me at the end, within 5 minutes of shutting things down, one of them said, well, the time card, let's bring the time card up. Well, I started laughing. I just thought it was hilarious because we could prove that the time card was an actual time card. So at the end of the show, they were both sitting there, and I reached over and I shook both their hands. And I said, I'm going to tell you something. Let's close this with, I agree to disagree, because I'd planned to do another show when I could bring out some stuff. Let me give you one thing that you don't know. And I'll share with you. And I shouldn't, but I am. You remember who Kardashian is, right?
Of course.
Okay. He told a person, a family member, that he had read my book. And he said to this person, I know I'm ill, but he said, if you can ever see Mr. Deere, please tell him. He got it right. OJ didn't commit the murder. Jason did.
Wow. Yeah. No, it's... I got to admit,
and I can prove exactly what I said.
Look, I heard you've said that publicly. you let that slip. You said that in another podcast. I would love it if you could tell me something that truly you haven't shared with anybody. I'm privileged to have this time and for you to share.
There's
things you have to keep.
What I could give you is a tidbit.
No. I understand. Yeah. I understand. I don't want to disrupt anything because I think that this deserves. So, look, I want to respect your time, but a couple more very quick things. Why do you think culturally there is so much resistance to the idea that OJ is innocent? Culturally, I think the moment has come where we can see a big shift. Whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's we've become accustomed to people being exonerated after decades in prison. I feel like the pendulum is. Really swung here, and there could be a real shift. But why do you think there's so much resistance?
I'm going to agree with what you just said. I think the pendulum will swing the other way. White lives matter, Latino lives matter, Black lives matter, whatever. They all lives to me matter. In this particular situation, there was a lot of animosity toward LAPD. You had the Rampart Division, you had Floyd, you have a lot of stuff. But the trouble with people, they make a decision without knowing the facts. Yeah. When this man sent this email to me, I started laughing because I knew he didn't know the facts. If they knew all the facts, then they could make that decision. But you can't make a decision from what you just hear and not know and see.
That's true. And it's really a compelling thing when you start debating somebody who doesn't know anything. You just ask them a question. You know, Central Park Five, that's a case that I'm obsessed with. And they'll say they're all innocent. And I say, who are they? Well, the Central Park Five. Well, name one of the defendants. And they never can. You know what I mean? Like they don't know. They literally don't know the first thing about it. All right. The anniversary is coming up in 2 months. What do you have planned? What could we possibly?
Well, I put together a proposal for a 30-year anniversary, but I don't care if it's a 30-year anniversary. I'd like to get it to, you know, I've got a lot of things that were not in that show. Actually, Discover claimed it was their number one show. And the other thing you've got to keep in mind, too, that women are tenacious. They really dig deep. When they did a survey as to viewers, as you know today, they determined that 70% of the viewers on that show in 2016 were women. When you look at the amount of shows that are on television today, about 40, 50% of them are true crime shows. Mm. And to me, I think people are getting into it, but they want to see it. They want to fix it. They want to analyze it, and they want the facts. So I put together this binder that contains everything for the show that lets you be the jury. I just haven't submitted it to anybody yet. Should have, but I just haven't. But if we do get another 6-part series or whatever it may be, I think I can convince the general public that this is the way it really is. And let's be honest about it. The case, I don't care. We got an email many years ago from LAPD, Public Relations Department. O.J. Simpson was found innocent in a trial. We found him to be guilty. Case closed. You don't close a case in homicide. If it's not solved, it's not solved. It's still an open case. I don't care whether it's cold case or what it is. It's still an open case. And so that's the way I feel about it. I feel bad because, to me, when I see the picture when OJ was found not guilty and the stoic face on Jason, when all the other people in his family going, oh, congrats, and then to realize that if I'm right in way and I feel very comfortable with it, I'm looking at the investigation. So that's why I'm looking at all the fine points. I'm looking at, I interviewed the, which we haven't discussed and I don't discuss very seldom, but I just found that the, Jason was being, interviewed by a psychologist, part of the thing for OJ and Nicole and for Jason. And I interviewed him and he very carefully slipped from LA, lives in Corpus Christi, but I have a statement from him and a recording from him, which finds it very interesting that he destroyed all the records. I don't want to get off too much on
no,
this.
I get it. Anyway, no,
there's
no.
A lot more. There's a lot more to this. And
okay, I have one more question for you. Are you a Christian?
Oh, yes.
Do you believe that Jason can find forgiveness? I mean, I believe he can find forgiveness if he actually did this, and I think there's a substantial chance that he did. I think that there's hope even for somebody like that, even for a double murderer, even for anybody, no matter what they've done. Do you believe that?
I interviewed the top psychologist here who does, you know, they do the interviews of the criminal. He felt that Jason was going to do it again. Well, it's been a long period of time. He's married now, no children, but I know they have serious problems from what I've been told. Do I believe that God will forgive him? I think OJ probably forgave him, and I think he forgave himself. I hope that that's the case because he has a lot to live with. And in thinking about that, because I feel I'm a Christian, I've tried to give him the benefit of the doubt. But I know he's got to live with this no matter what. His father spent 9 years in prison. I know why he spent. That was the biggest phony case in Las Vegas that you'd ever put together. I have plenty of lawyers and judges who've told me it was phony. I know who set him up in Las Vegas. And that's sad, but it's never been brought out. But this is a big case. But in answer to your question, yes, I think on his deathbed, he probably forgave his son.
How about that? What an interesting guy. All right, officially, I got to say this. The killings of Nicole Brown Simpson
and Ronald Goldman are crimes that remain unsolved. The opinions expressed in this podcast represent just some of the many conceivable scenarios regarding how those crimes may have occurred. With that, I special thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers. It's still okay to say thoughts and prayers. Yes, I will pray for the family of Ronald Goldman, for the family of Nicole Brown Simpson, and yes, for the family of O.J. Simpson, including his son, Jason. Jason, you might be innocent of all this. Then again, these theories are interesting and compelling. I'll just say that I do believe, and I believe you believe, that forgiveness of sins is available to each and every one of us. And you definitely had some tough breaks in life. We all do, but you had some unique ones, unique challenges. And this may be all much ado about nothing, or then again. So the choice is really up to you what to do next. I wish everybody well. I got to go. Bye-bye.